recap from last week. I'm going to start right in the middle of things. I know some of you weren't here. Hopefully Gary has the recording up at Sermon Audio. My wisdom preserved for the ages. What a frightening idea. All right, here's a recap. Any knowledge claim, or any claim to knowledge, can be made with respect to one of two areas. Just following Plato, and I'm just putting this scheme up here because it's helpful, not necessarily because I think Christians ought to follow it. Number one, it's dichotomous. In other words, you have these two things in sort of opposition or contrast to each other. And Christian thinking really isn't dichotomous. But I'm not going to go into that more right now. Knowledge claims with respect to one or both of two areas, realm of being, realm of becoming. And this, like I said, is a Platonic idea. What Plato would want to say is that in order to have true knowledge, you have to have knowledge of something that is unchanging, unalterable, timeless. So it's eternal. If you don't have that, then what you have is knowledge of becoming. So you think of the world we live in as the realm of becoming. Everything's in a state of change, constant state of flux. Nothing remains the same over time. So what you have with respect to becoming is belief. What you have with respect to being is knowledge. And then this is another way of thinking of it, rather of thinking of the problem, the relation of universal to particular. Covered also the various ways in which these things are resolved in terms of each other. Plato, there's a very nice passage in one of his dialogues. It's the Phaedo, if you can imagine. List two basic ways of coming to knowledge. You can latch on to the best human theory you can find, unless you can lay claim to some word from God. I raise that fact because the Christian theistic solution to the problem in the Middle Ages was revelation. You can get knowledge of this realm, these unchanging, unalterable, eternal truths, by virtue of revelation. Then we went on to discuss the deist and then the naturalist view. Because of the behavior of the church and other matters, the deists and naturalists decided, no, we're not going to mess with revelation. We can get to here from here. And the postmodern, where we're at now, is a denial that you can make this jump from the realm of becoming to the realm of being. For one of two reasons, both of which really are kind of the same thing. One is, there's no here to get to. There's just this. Nietzsche, in talking about knowledge, says, what if everything is just becoming? There is no eternal, there's no timeless, there's no unchanging. What if everything is just becoming? Knowledge is based on the belief in this. That there is this realm and you can have knowledge. If you deny this, then you don't have this. You don't have knowledge. Deny being, no knowledge. That's what Nietzsche says. And he's right, as far as I'm concerned. And really, in a lot of ways, that's what postmodernism is. A denial of the possibility of knowledge because there's no being. Either it's not there, metaphysically, that is, it really doesn't exist anywhere, not even in the mind of God, or you can't get there from here, which is much the same thing. If you can't get there from here, then it doesn't matter whether this is there or not. Think of yourself as standing perhaps on one side of the Grand Canyon at a time when there's no way to get across. How much difference does it make that there is a there if you can't get there? You can speculate about it. You can talk about what might be over the horizon on the other side of the Grand Canyon, but really, for all practical purposes, there's no there over time. You'd probably lose interest in it. And you would run the course of your life and not give the other side of that canyon another thought, perhaps. That's sort of the situation that we're in. Now, I made the claim that the Christian theistic view has it that you can get knowledge of being by virtue of revelation. Let me give you an example of that. I should have given an example last week so that you can see exactly how that works out. Think of Jeremiah 17:9. I'm not going to quote it. I'm just going to hit the heart of it. That passage says that the human heart is deceitful and desperately wicked. That's a statement about this realm. It makes a statement about human nature. It is human nature that the heart is wicked and deceitful. So we meet a guy named John Doe, a very popular guy, and we don't know much about him. What do we know about John Doe when we just meet him?
His heart is deceitful.
Yeah, like ours. Always remember, always critical to remember that it also applies to you. Well, actually, that would be you, not me, of course. Thank you for laughing. Now, think of a similar claim. Well, a similar kind of claim. Well, Paul says in Romans chapter 3, verse 23, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Another statement about this realm. It isn't just about particulars. Think about if you didn't have revelation, how could you come to this knowledge that the human heart is deceitful and wicked? How could you come to this knowledge that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God? I look at you. You're a particular human being. Size you up. You weigh this. You're this tall. You have two eyes, some color, hair, some color. I can list all these facts about you. But when it comes to saying your heart is desperately wicked, don't I have a problem just saying that about one human being? You're desperately wicked and deceitful. Make me ill. Make my skin crawl. That's one of the reasons why the postmodern denial of being able to do this. I said last week, when you study particulars, when you study becoming, all you get is more particulars and more crazy ideas about becoming. Getting up here, thank you for playing.
Well,
oh, it's always you.
They can't
no rest for the wicked.
Unless God has mercy on them. And
right, which is the Christian theistic view.
Yeah, but he would reveal to God.
That's an idea they don't like. Why should he reveal it to you and not me? All humans are equal, right? But, yeah, that's the Christian theistic position. We need to have our eyes opened. We need to be regenerated. Then we can access revelation. But that's, I think everyone now has a pretty good grip on the problem, right? Yes. Now, there's an ethical component to that. Think about another similar type of saying, thou shalt not murder. Now here's how that is a statement with respect to being. When we analyze scripture, we analyze the law, and we analyze what God says not to do, and then we look at that part of his justification, a lot of times you read through the law, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, I am the Lord. One of the things he says is thou shalt not murder. And then there's discussion of the murderer being put to death because man is an image bearer. Statement about being. The statement about being is this. The human being has some value such that should his life be taken but for reasons given by God, the murderer forfeits his life. The statement about being. Think about it. So are certain other statements that people don't like to hear us say. You know, statements like mankind shall not lie with mankind. Again, the statement being that there is on this level being, something about being male or female, which means when it comes to lying together, males don't lie with males, females don't lie with females. Now, there are some Christians who take issue with that, but we'd have to have that discussion with them, and certainly not today because I'm very busy because we're doing interpretation here. Now, this talk of being and becoming is relevant to interpretation. Why? Am I just talking about postmodernism because I think it's cool, I think you should know, and Lord knows you all need to know what it is I think I need to know. Why does this matter to interpretation? There may not be one right answer, so yes, you can give the answer that you think, or the answer that comes to your mind, not necessarily the answer you think that I want to hear. Just think about you. There you are. You want to be better readers of the Bible, so hopefully that's why you're sitting through this years-long session on biblical interpretation. And I'm giving now 2 weeks' worth of a quick and dirty guide to postmodernism. Why is it important to you? If I have failed to make it important to you, so be it. But if you're thinking that this is somehow important. Why is it important to you with respect to interpretation of the Bible? I know. You're all waiting to hear my answer. And you should. The statement, this passage means this. What kind of statement is that? Yeah. If the passage really means this, even if we're wrong, but if the passage really means this, then we're making a statement about being. This is the unchanging, the unalterable, the eternal. This is what the passage means. What it means now, what it means tomorrow, what it means 100 years from now, this is what the passage means. It's a similar type of statement, and it's a bold statement, especially in this day and age. Statements about meaning are statements about becoming, being, not statements about becoming. So, if you deny the category of being, what must you also deny? You have to deny that there is such a thing as an interpretation. You have to deny that there's such a thing as the meaning. And so you get, I won't bore you with all the details, but you get all these schools of thought about how to come to a text these days. And I think one of the most popular, one of the most famous, I think, is Stanley Fish's version of reader response. The only text that exists and has a meaning is the text you read. Why not? It's not like you can make a statement about being. It's not there. Or if it is, you can't get there. Unless, of course, the Bible is a revelation. But even then, you come to the text, you read it, you give it a meaning. No interpretation. No meaning. So, if you're outside of the church and you're looking at these theological dogfights in the church, Roman Catholics versus the Protestants, and you got these guys going for the federal vision, these guys going against the federal vision, then you got Lutherans talking about the ubiquitousness of the body, then you got Reformed people like me saying, well, you Lutherans really don't like reason, so that's why you believe that a physical body can be everywhere at once. Then, of course, you got me saying that. You got all these dogfights. You guys catch all that? You can listen to this and slow it down. Doesn't it look like a lot of nonsense if you're outside of that milieu? Watching it go on. Now, here's a real world example for you. You see this all the time at work, in case you didn't know. Every couple of years in American life, we get treated to a battle. A battle over the court. Who's going to sit on it? And every few years, people wonder why. Why is it so hard to just interpret the Constitution? Well, why is it so hard to interpret the Constitution? We have on one hand this talk of this living, breathing document. Then we have this talk of originalism. Now just ask yourself how the situation now can be otherwise. How could it be otherwise? What you really have, really, I think, is a very... When we have these battles over the courts, I think that you have a real-world illustration of postmodernists and modernists confronting each other and having battles of wits. And the originalists want to say, you can do this. You can get to the original meaning of the Constitution and you can apply that original meaning. And you have postmodernist people who love them saying, actually, no, you can't. No belief in being, no belief in meaning. So all you have is the creation of a meaning, getting back to Stanley Fish's version of reader response. The reader creates a meaning. And why should he not be entitled to add his creative meaning to everyone else's and think that it ought to be considered equal to everyone else's, no matter how nonsensical it is? Why shouldn't a Supreme Court justice cite foreign law and make that foreign law part of our Constitution? Why not? Then, once you do that, once you create a meaning, what do you need to do to get that meaning to stick? What do you need to have when you create that meaning? If it's the meaning of a normative text, you know, everyone understand what I mean by normative? It tells you what you're going to do, what you're not going to do. It's normative. It defines our beliefs, theologically, and even to some extent philosophically, and it defines our actions, what we should do, what we should not do. It's normative. Now you apply all this to a normative text. What do you need once you create a meaning?
More laws.
Why do we have the battles over the courts? Because people think we need more laws, or is it something else?
They don't want to have laws.
It's a normative text.
What? I agree. Yeah.
Oh, there's something you can do even if everybody won't agree. Or you can certainly have a motivated agreement. You know, hi, how are you? There's what I think we should understand by this text. Everybody with me? What do you need when you create the meaning, and it's the meaning of a normative document, to make that meaning stick?
You have to change the thinking of everybody so that they agree with you. You have to educate that.
Educate. Educate kind of means...
Doctrine.
No, but there's a battle over the court. It's not a battle between law schools. It's a battle over the court. Who sits on it? What's one of the big issues? Roe v. Wade. Anybody ever read it? Let me be very bold and very blunt about Roe v. Wade. It sucks. Has a bit of legal reasoning. But it sticks. Why? So you're struggling with this because you're not used to thinking like this, I know, but you need to get accustomed to thinking like this, because once I drop the word on you, you're going to say, oh, yeah. Not because you've never heard it or thought of it before, but because, yes? What were you saying?
It's what people
want to
hear.
Ambiguities. The reason can go either direction.
No, they like that. You create a meaning. Remember, you create a meaning. Every meaning is equal to every other possible meaning.
Roe v. Wade took away basically rights of even non-born.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Tiptoe through the tulips with me. What is the court? Say branch of.
Government.
What do governments do? And what does rule involve?
Power.
That's what you need to make an interpretation stick. No matter how arbitrary it is, even if everybody knows you made it up out of whole cloth, you got the power, your creative meaning sticks. So every couple of years we have this battle. Because there's this document. It's normative, and people think there's some meaning in it. Some people don't think there's some meaning in it. But whatever the case with respect to meaning, whether you discover that meaning because it's really there, truly and honestly, or you create that meaning, when it comes to law, what difference does it make if you can't carry through your will? You'll remember that last week I let you know that the book from Nietzsche I was quoting from was Will to Power. You read Will to Power, and you read a guy who wrote a roadmap. He saw it all in the 19th century. Yes.
Where is he from?
Nietzsche.
Nietzsche.
He's Swiss.
Swiss?
Well, he was, until he died.
Long.
He's probably still Swiss, but he's not having a good time.
Theories are full
of. Oh, no, they're not.
I know, but it's just going to be funny.
Oh, you're making reference to Swiss cheese. Got it. Okay. So, There's no purpose in talking about originalism, because what is originalism? It's just a method of meaning creation, isn't it? If you deny this, and someone talks to you about originalism, what's he talking to you about? He can't be talking to you about a method of discovering meaning. It's not there. So he must be talking to you about a method of creating meaning. And why should his method of creating meaning be superior to anyone else's method of creating meaning? See where we are?
But can the postmodernists even make that claim without denying their foundation? Because they can't say anything about being at all. They can't say you can't do this, or you should do that, or you shouldn't do that, because then they deny themselves. Because they're automatically saying, in my perspective, there is a being.
That's why, on the other hand, that's why on one hand, we're tempted not to take this seriously. And so, well, that's nuts. You know, you say there's no absolutes. Well, that itself is an absolute. But that's why I came up with the analogy of the Grand Canyon earlier. They can put it more weakly and still be right. It doesn't have to be the case that this isn't there. But it is the case that we can't get there from here. And that is true. We cannot get here from here. You can't go from becoming to being. particular to universal. You can't do that. They are right.
But that is universal.
However, yes, but however problematic it is, they are right. They are.
I just can't see how that you claim something and then take it back and deny it at the same time. And I think that people...
But you're assuming what many of them deny, which is that there is a duty to be logical and rational in the first place. And many of them don't. Reason is a nice, cute little artifact. See, we've gone from a confident reason rooted in Christian theism to an arrogant rationalism in deism and naturalism to a despondent rationalism with the postmodernists. We were confident because we had a word from God. Then we were arrogant because we had our brains. Now, we're despondent. Yeah, there is something to what you say, but...
Well,
so what? Because what you're saying is right up here. They understand the predicament. They'll just don't make the mistake of thinking that you're dealing with simple-minded people. You're not. Because they are right. And probably no one knows better than they the nature of their predicament. That's why I use the term despondent rationalism. Pardon? Probably in the same way that a man thinks he's right if he comes to the conclusion that his wife's committing adultery. It's not something he wants necessarily to be right about. He'd like it to be other than what it is. But it is what it is. And he is right. I mean, this is the paradox. He is right. But it's not a problem for us because we know he's right in our experience because we experience exactly what he needs to experience, which is the breaking in of being into becoming. You think of Plato's cave. He talks about those prisoners being chained up and they see the shadows on the walls. And then he speculates, what if a prisoner got loose? Well, we don't have to speculate what if a prisoner got loose. The light of the world comes into the cave. And that's why this is such a problem for you, because you can't, you see what I mean? That's not your problem. You're not looking up at a ceiling that closes you off from what's up there, because what's up there has come in to your life and has broken in. That's not their experience. All they're telling you, Bob, is what their experience is. And that's why they would deny that they're doing the same thing, because they're only telling you phenomenologically what they see. The report they're giving you is like the report someone's giving you when he says the sun rose. When we step back from a different perspective, we say, well, the sun didn't rise, the earth rotates. But if he's giving you the phenomenal perspective, just the barest fact, he looks out at the horizon, he watches the sun rise. The sun does rise. He is right, because he's talking about the sun in relation to the horizon. The postmodernist is right because he's talking about the relation of being to becoming from the perspective of being and not being able to jump up. I'm sorry, from the perspective of becoming unable to jump up to the realm of being. And that's why I've kept saying over and over again, he's right. It's not that I think he's right the same way as someone looking at the solar system from outside would say that the sun rises. It doesn't. When you look at the solar system from the outside, the sun doesn't rise. The earth rotates. But you step onto the earth, describe from the level of phenomena what you see. The sun rises, and the sun also sets. Could resist. So on these terms, what is the act of persuasion? I'm moving on, unless you wanted to...
Well, when it comes down to us engaging them, it would be, in my mind, on par with engaging a schizophrenic. Do you buy into their worldview and try to deal with them on their worldview? Or do you flatly deny the fact that whatever paranoia you've got is not reality, but this is reality? I don't see myself giving them any credence or legitimacy on their claim. Because one, they deny their claim as soon as they say it. They take it back in what they say.
But again... You have to take the claim from the perspective it's made from. Again, if someone is standing on the earth and says the sun rises, you have to do something with that. You have to credit that somehow. You may know differently, but But you have to credit that claim somehow in order even to begin. Now, I don't mean that we adopt postmodernism. Some Christians do that, and I think that makes as much sense as a Christian adopting deism, for crying out loud. But you have to credit the report of experience. You have to credit his report to you of what he sees. If you won't do that, frankly, I think it's justified in not giving you any time.
But in order to give it credit, you have to compare it with something to know that it...
Well, you can say that, but let's say you meet someone, you know, from Papua New Guinea, and talks about the sunrise. How soon in your relationship with him do you start talking about astronomy? Before he's even seen a telescope? You know, before you've taken... See, what I would say that you'd have to do really is you would have to carry him from geocentrism up to the present conception, and you would have to do it by the same steps that, you know, Western thinking went. You'd have to take them from the observation of the planets. You know what? Let me credit your report about the sunrise. Well, leave that alone. Let's start mapping the heavens. Let's start observing the stars, the planets. Well, when you see the planets do these weird little things where you got one over here, and then it seems to come back over here, we have all these weird-looking orbitals. Where, you know, you've got one, it's kind of orbiting the Earth, but, it, you know, does this sort of thing around it. You ever watch, like, Venus or Mars in your... No? Very fascinating. For me. When that doesn't work, when, you know, when he can see that that isn't working, that conception of the planets isn't working, you know, then you take the next step, which is going to be heliocentrism. Now, you know... You just have to do that by steps. But that's how you credit a report with which you really and truly disagree. But in order to get from there to here, you know, you can't just grab them by the ears. You're wrong. When you make a statement like that, you're contradicting your own. Because again, he's only given you a report of his experience. He's telling you what he sees. And you have to credit that report, I think. But beyond that, the answer to your question is, I don't know.
But somebody that is consciously postmodern and embraces postmodernism consciously has, they're not on the same degree as the person that's little.
Well, quite frankly, I think very few people have made a conscious decision for postmodernism. I think a lot of people are postmodernists in the way that a lot of people grow up Christians. They really and literally, truly don't remember not being a Christian. They were raised in a Christian home. That's their... And they really do have a personal commitment to Jesus Christ. They're just not aware of when they made that commitment. So I think a lot of people do have an intellectual commitment to postmodernism without having the postmodernist gospel preached to them and walking down the aisle and getting baptized into postmodernism and getting confirmed in postmodernism and every week gathering together for the celebration of the postmodern Lord Communion. I don't think for the most people that's it. Deists still thought in moral categories given to them by Christians.
But I've talked to the Hindu, very postmodern.
Well, yeah, after sure.
Perspective. And she was consciously so. And every argument about anything that was...
Oh, I was postmodern as when I was young. I didn't believe you could have knowledge. But I didn't make a conscious decision for postmodernism. I took what was given to me and ran with it. You know, and basically my walk to faith began with an observation like the sun rises. And I walked through, if you'll, you know, follow the analogy with me, geocentrism, heliocentrism, to contemporary view of astronomy. You know, that's what I've got to say about that. The other thing I've got to say is I haven't worked out... I read a lot of different books on how to relate to postmodernism and people who hold the view. Some I find satisfying... But to really take up that further would really be to want to do another course in apologetics. Because I feel like I'm going to redo that scene from Fiddler on the Roof. You're also right. But being right and being wrong is sometimes a matter of perspective. Now, one perspective is the right perspective and the other perspective is, you know, not right. Depending upon what it is you're looking after. From a perspective that has to be credited... The sun rises. from a different perspective, the perspective of being able somehow to see into the solar system. The sun does not rise, the earth revolves around it and rotates as it does so. And that explains the sunrise, because now we understand what a horizon is. As the earth turns and the sun comes into view over the horizon, that is the sunrise. But for the most part, I haven't worked that out. Really, it's one of the central preoccupations of my intellectual life right now. Because everyone thinks they know how to deal with postmodernism, and when I watch the people implement what they think is the way to do it, I don't see that it's done with a whole lot of, I don't want to say success. It's just, as a former postmodernist myself, I listen to them and I think, I can't understand why you think that's working. So that's why I have to keep my mouth shut a lot, because I have figured it out myself. However, as long as you've raised that that issue, hopefully now you're in a position to understand what I'm about to say next, which is that on this view of things, what we think of as persuasion is an act of force. And that also explains the resistance. It's not just a matter of being stubborn. It's just a matter of understanding that the way they perceive things, the attempt to persuade, is an act of force. I've got two things to say, and it's already five after. Time to leave. Well, let me just... No, I'm going to have to do it at the beginning of next class, and then we'll jump into the next... We're going to start looking at interpretation per se. And the first thing we're going to deal with is context. But even if I say the two things that I need to say, there's some development that's going to take more than just 2 minutes. So let me stop right here, and then next week the first thing I'll do is finish this off, and then we'll start dealing with context.